Cummings and his entire staff for accommodating us here today, and they've done a terrific job, and we are grateful for that. We have one case to be submitted this afternoon on oral argument. We'll hear Barber versus Bryant. Mr. Mitchell.
May it please the court. A preliminary injunction cannot issue unless a litigant makes a clear showing that he will likely succeed on the merits. The plaintiffs in this case have failed to make a clear showing of Article III standing, and more importantly, they have failed to make a clear showing that Mississippi's conscience protection law is unconstitutional. For both of these reasons, the preliminary injunction should be vacated, and this court should specifically hold that the constitutional challenges to Mississippi's law are without merit. There is no obstacle to this court reaching the merits of the constitutional claims, even if it were to conclude that the plaintiffs have failed to make a clear showing of Article III standing, because this case comes to the court on appeal from a preliminary injunction. And the Article III inquiry is limited to whether the plaintiffs have made a preliminary showing based on the pleadings and the factual record as they currently exist, of whether they've made a clear showing of Article III standing. There's no obstacle to this court going on to reach the merits if it makes the tentative preliminary conclusion that at this time there is no clear showing of Article III standing.
If they don't have standing, that deprives the court of subject matter jurisdiction, and then
that's
the proper
correct
response is to vacate and dismiss the case. It's not to say, oh, but if they did have standing, here's what we think.
Judge Haynes, that's correct. If there is a final, if there is a final and conclusive determination that the plaintiffs lack Article III standing, the only proper response is to announce that fact and dismiss the cause for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. That is right. Under no circumstance can a court that lacks subject matter jurisdiction rule on the merits or enter judgment on the merits. But this case is coming to the court on appeal from a preliminary injunction. It's a cursory, abbreviated record, and the only question to resolve at this time in the litigation is whether a clear showing of Article III standing has been made based on the current state of the pleadings and the current state of this preliminary injunction record, which is pre-discovery. A ruling that the plaintiffs have failed to make the clear showing needed for a preliminary injunction is not a final and conclusive determination that they lack Article III standing, because it's possible.
But the problem with this conclusive thing that you keep mm-hmm. saying is, for example, on equal protection, we might say, hey, on a facial challenge, under the Moore case, et cetera, you haven't shown standing. However, it could be down the road that somebody's denied a service because of somebody's Section 2 beliefs, et cetera, et cetera, and then has suffered a concrete and particularized injury, and they can file a new lawsuit. And there would be no res judicata effect of a finding that the facial challenge lacks standing. Is that fair?
That's right. If this
so
is
you're saying conclusive, you don't mean to say that forever and ever, till death do us part, do we say that somebody would never be able to establish standing, say, for example, on the equal protection. It's simply that at this point, they haven't done that.
Right. Article III standing is a factual question. It's a question of fact. Is there an injury in fact? Have they shown causation? Have they shown redressability? That requires not only factual allegations in the complaint, but it will require evidence obtained through discovery to see whether any one of these plaintiffs, or perhaps new plaintiffs they might add later to this litigation, could establish the requisite evidence of Article III standing. This,
Mr.
though, is
Mitchell,
at a preliminary stage.
Do you have any examples where we have done what we would be seeking us to do, to say preliminarily the Article III standing is not met, and also preliminarily they've not shown the likelihood of success? Is there an example of such a case in our precedent?
I have not found an example from this court of this court doing such a thing, but there are many examples of this court and other courts issuing alternate holdings. There's nothing at all improper about that. A court can say you lose for one of two reasons, each of which standing alone is sufficient, but we will use both of these reasons to justify.
There's a lot of case law that says you can't assume jurisdiction.
That's correct.
So
you can't.
So there's three or four different attacks on jurisdiction, ripeness, mootness. It's a pure state law question that you don't have the whatever. So on and on and on, there might be a number of different avenues to say that that you lack jurisdiction, and then we can pick one of those and an alternate one of those. But once there's a conclusion that we lack jurisdiction, we can't go, but if we had jurisdiction, mm-hmm. in the alternative, we say they also didn't meet this or that.
That's correct.
I'm not understanding why you're making this argument.
All that's correct, Judge Haynes.
Okay.
This court's jurisdiction is secure under 1291. The district court entered an injunction. We appealed. This court has appellate jurisdiction under 1291 to review the entire district court order, both with respect to the standing analysis and the merits. Whether the district court has subject matter jurisdiction will depend on whether the plaintiffs can establish Article III standing on remand if they can allege and prove injury, causation, and redressability. They have not made a clear showing at this point to warrant a preliminary injunction. That does not necessarily mean that they will be unable to do that later, and it does not necessarily mean that the district court must immediately dismiss the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. There still is jurisdiction in the district court to determine whether it has jurisdiction, and Article III standing is ultimately a factual question. With respect to the merits of the constitutional claim, by contrast, that's a pure question of law. There's no need for further factual development to determine that the Establishment Clause and Equal Protection Clause claims lack merit.
So you are saying, I'm not indicating whether I agree or don't agree, but you're saying that we would, in fact, under that scenario, be able to issue a binding ruling on the merits if we were so inclined.
That's correct.
A ruling that would be as binding as though we were on a merits appeal rather than an injunction appeal. Is that?
That's correct. Now, the only circumstance in which you would be unable to do so would be if this court were to conclude that the plaintiffs absolutely cannot, under any circumstance, establish Article III standing, perhaps because they pleaded themselves out of court in the complaint. Now, we're not arguing that they've pleaded themselves out of court. The complaint does not contain sufficient allegations of Article III standing. But that's not necessarily something that warrants immediate and permanent dismissal. If a complaint lacks sufficient factual allegations, the normal remedy is a motion for a more definite statement under 12E, not for the district court to throw them out for failing to put the facts in the complaint. The question on remand will be whether the plaintiffs can adequately plead sufficient facts to establish Article III standing consistent with their Rule 11 obligations.
So based on what you've said, and speaking, of course, as an officer of the court, but also on behalf of your clients, summarize for us in a sentence or two, you could fill in the lines blanks later, what it is that you request this court to do on this appeal from an injunction.
We're asking the court to vacate the preliminary injunction.
Well, I know, but start with the standing and then get to the merits. Again, in one or two or three sentences.
We're asking the court to hold the plaintiffs failed to make a clear showing of Article III standing that's needed to warrant a preliminary injunction, and that in the alternative, the plaintiffs also failed to make a clear showing that Mississippi's conscience protection law is unconstitutional. And for both of these reasons, each standing alone, the district court's preliminary injunction order was unlawful and must be vacated.
What you just told us, thank you for answering my question, you did so directly. But it sounds as to the second half as though it's different from what you told us a few minutes ago, that in terms of having a definitive ruling on the merits. You're not asking for a definitive ruling on the merits, such as the example that you gave if the plaintiffs had pled themselves out of court.
I believe that is a definitive ruling because this is a legal deficiency with the plaintiff's argument, as opposed to Article III standing, which is a factual question. And at this point, there are not sufficient facts in the preliminary injunction record to warrant a clear showing. The plaintiff's arguments on the merits, based on the Establishment Clause and Equal Protection Clause, should be rejected definitively by this court. That also means, obviously, they failed to make a clear showing.
I mean, not to make a pun since cakes are involved here, but aren't you having your cake and eating it too? Because you're kind of saying, we lack jurisdiction, but we should say, and also, by the way, we don't like your argument.
No. We're not saying the court lacks jurisdiction, Judge Haynes.
Well, that
this
is the
court has
a lack of standing, Counselor. I mean, I understand you're trying to put it in this, you didn't definitively prove, but your whole brief, at least as part of the standing, is that you have to prove standing to recover,
yes.
And they failed to do that. And so to me, there's no, that we're past the notion. notion of just looking at the face of the pleading, but you also think on the face of the pleading they didn't assert standing.
That's correct.
And so we don't go around going, well, maybe someday you'll prove standing. If you do, you come back and file another lawsuit. That's why I asked about the ratio of caught. Why isn't it, if we say, you know what, you haven't proved standing, we vacate and dismiss, and then down the road the plaintiffs think they now have a more clear case of standing. They file that. There's no res judicata effect of the prior case because we lacked jurisdiction. Why isn't that the right outcome?
If they have conclusively failed to establish standing after discovery and after factual development of the record, then the case must be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. That's correct. But right now, we're at the preliminary injunction stage. The question is whether they made a clear showing in the district court based on the record of Article III standing.
Okay, let me ask you this, because I think Judge Arad asked this, but I want to be sure I'm clear. You don't have a case that has this sort of standing approach
no.
where, well, they're in standing, but maybe someday you can establish it, so we're going to keep giving you tries, and while you're there, we're going to put our thumb on the scale and go, here's what we think.
Judge Haynes, that's not what we're arguing.
Okay. All right.
Steelco, the Supreme Court decision in 1998, is very clear that a court cannot decide the merits of a case based on hypothetical standing. It cannot be assumed. We are not in any way questioning Steelco, and we want to make clear to this court that no court, this court, the district court, no federal court is permitted to rule on the merits if there is a lack of Article III standing. That is a jurisdictional prerequisite. The challenge in this case is that the standing inquiry is a fact-bound question. They have failed at this point of the proceedings to allege sufficient facts in their complaint and to put sufficient facts in the preliminary injunction record that could warrant a preliminary injunction. But we are still early in this case. We have not even yet moved to dismiss under 12b-6 or even 12b-1 in the district court. And the district court still has jurisdiction going forward to determine its own jurisdiction and find out whether the plaintiffs will be able to produce the necessary factual evidence and the necessary pleadings in their complaint to establish Article III standing. Nothing precludes this court from reaching the merits in that scenario. We are not asking this court to assume jurisdiction.
I'm going to ask you about the merits of the standing argument, because I think I've heard what you have to say about the procedure, and I find it a little odd, but it's fine. We still need to discuss whether there is standing. Okay. However, whatever happens as a result of that. So let me ask you what I'll call the merits standing question. As I understand it, you're saying that there's nothing here that allows them to make an establishment clause claim because they haven't been impacted or in any way by any establishment clause alleged violation. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. What if Section 2, instead of reading that one of the protected beliefs is marriage is or should be recognized as a union of one man and one woman, instead it read, and this is a hypothetical, I understand, but instead it read, marriage is or should be recognized as a union of one man and one woman of the same race. This is a hypothetical. I'm not at all advocating that as a statute. I'm saying if it said that, would that change the standing analysis at all?
No, it would not. You would still need a plaintiff with Article III injury, and a plaintiff would have to show that he is in imminent, impending, certainly impending, or a substantial risk of suffering some personal and concrete harm on account of that statute. Now, would they be able to find a plaintiff? It's quite likely they would. But nothing would change on the standing inquiry.
For establishment, I'm not talking about equal protection. I think we understand that. But on the establishment clause, what is the particular harm that, say, an African-American man who wants to marry an Asian woman, what particular harm, under my hypothetical, or even let's back up and take the statute as is, a man wants to marry another man, what is the concrete and particularized injury they would have to show for the establishment clause?
Well, first they would have to show they're about to get married. And none of the plaintiffs in this case, except Rennick Taylor, even alleges that he's about to get married. And then they would have to show that they're going to get married in Mississippi and that they are at substantial risk of having services denied from someone whom they're planning to ask to provide
protection. What about the establishment?
Well, either way, they still need to show injury in fact. And the injury needs to be personal and concrete. It needs to be certainly impending. There needs to be a substantial risk that something will happen to them beyond mere offense taken at the statute. So what they would need to find in your hypothetical, Your Honor, is the same showing they need to make with respect to this case. They need to find a plaintiff who is planning a wedding and who is showing a substantial risk that someone will deny him services on account of this law. They would then have to show that the law is causing that denial of services and that it could be redressed with a favorable ruling from this court.
So you see no difference between equal protection standing and Establishment Clause standing, contrary to the Moore case that just came out?
There may be a difference in the type of injuries that can qualify as injury in fact under Article 3. For example, there's taxpayer standing that's acceptable in the Establishment Clause context that is not accepted as an injury anywhere else. We certainly accept that proposition, but there's no scenario in which the plaintiffs in this case have shown an Article 3 injury for either equal protection or Establishment Clause purposes, and the inquiry with respect to standing would not change under Your Honor's hypothetical. Of course, the merits would change, and we say that in our brief. We're very clear. A statute such as the one that Your Honor has described would trigger strict scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause and could not survive that standard. So we are not in any way suggesting that Your Honor's hypothetical statute is constitutional, and it would be enjoined if there is
a
plaintiff with standing.
Would be the same.
The standing analysis would be the same. That's right. There still needs to be a plaintiff with an Article III injury caused by the statute.
And does it have to have an Article III injury, or you have to have a plaintiff for each section of the statute, right?
Well, it could be a plaintiff challenging multiple sections,
right,
but there needs to be
Article III. Right, or multiple sections, but
yes.
They have to be seeking to be a foster parent and also seek to be, I mean,
that's
there
right.
are multiple sections. Don't we analyze them each separately?
That's correct. I mean, the statute is severable, so there would need to be a plaintiff who is injured by the discrete section of the statute that the plaintiffs are seeking to enjoin. You know, they do have one plaintiff in the case who is alleging an imminent wedding, and that's Rennick Taylor. But as far as we know, there's no one in this case who is a foster child who could possibly be affected by Section 2 or Section 3 of the statute in any way, beyond an ideological injury.
Is it your position that on the wedding part of the statute that they not only have to allege an imminent wedding in Mississippi, but that they also have to say that they sought some services to rent a hall or to get a photographer or something?
I wouldn't quite go that far. I think it's enough if they can plead that they are going to seek those services from a person who they expect to deny them those services because this law exists. So it doesn't have to be that they've already gone through the trouble of asking and being denied, but they, at the very least, they need to show that they're getting married and getting married in Mississippi. Rennick Taylor does not even allege in the pleadings or in his own declaration that he's planning to get married in the state of Mississippi. We have no idea where his wedding's going to be.
Could you take us through just broadly what constitutes the preliminary injunction record in this case? We have many preliminary injunction cases in this circuit. What type of record was made here?
Well, we have the pleadings. We have a series of declarations from the Barber plaintiffs that begin on page 231 of the Barber record. Most of those declarations talk about offense as the injury. Actually, the declarations start on page 207. Rennick Taylor's specific declaration starts on page 231. There is a lengthy preliminary injunction hearing that starts on page 1077 of the CSE record. And there are some witnesses who testify, not so much a few of the plaintiffs testify, but most of the witnesses are expert witnesses put forth by the plaintiffs. So that's the those are the main components of the record. We have a series of declarations from the plaintiffs themselves. We had a lengthy hearing in front of Judge Reeves, and that's the evidence that this court currently has to go on. No depositions yet, no interrogatories, no discovery of that sort.
So within that universe, it's your position that no one says they're getting married in Mississippi?
As far as I know,
the entire universe of all the record, not just the pleadings.
I've read the record many times. I have not seen anyone other than Rennick Taylor who's alleging that he is getting married. And he does not even allege that he's getting married in the state of Mississippi. So we need a lot more detail than that before any court can conclude that there's a clear showing of standing to challenge Section 3.5, which is the one subsection of the statute that deals with wedding-related services. There are all sorts of other provisions where the case for standing is even weaker. For example, Section 3.4 of the statute deals with certain services like fertility services and counseling and sex change operations, and no plaintiff in this case is alleging that they're seeking fertility services or sex change operations from anyone, let alone from someone who might deny them those services on account of this Mississippi statute. So
let's get to the question of stigma, which you call it stigma, which other words could be used. And you've alluded to it. So the hypothetical, I think, was mentioned in the briefing, so I'll explore it. I mean, suppose that Mississippi passed a statute that said the official religion of Mississippi is Southern Baptist, Are you saying that no one would have standing under that statute?
Well, they would still have to show an Article III injury, and they would be suing an officer of the state, presumably, who is in charge with enforcing that statute. If the statute says nothing more than the official religion is Southern Baptist, there needs to be some duty for an executive official to carry out.
But, I mean, it would obviously violate the plain language of the First Amendment.
Yes, it would. But standing would be a complicated question there, Judge Smith, because first, under Ex parte Young, a plaintiff can only sue a state officer who is carrying out an executive duty or some administrative duty with respect to that law. And the way Your Honor has described the statute, it appears to be nothing more than a declaratory statement. Now, if there's a tax that's being imposed to fund the Southern Baptist Church, clearly there would be standing to enjoin that tax under the Supreme Court's taxpayer standing doctrine. If there is some public display of a religious symbol due to this statute's endorsement or establishment of the Southern Baptist religion, yes, there would be standing to enjoin that public display of a symbol by someone who regularly or at least one time encounters that symbol in his daily life. But without more detail, without knowing more about just exactly how the statute is implemented, I don't think I can give a candid answer to Your Honor's question, because a statute that does nothing more than make a statement but doesn't charge any state official with the duty of enforcement is not going to be able to produce a federal lawsuit under Ex parte Young.
Even though a statement can be stigmatizing as a practical matter.
That's right.
But you're saying that would never be enough here, given that simple hypothetical.
I don't believe causation or addressability could be established even independent of the stigma injury, because federal courts can't order a statute to be repealed. All they can do is enjoin state officials from enforcing a statute that's on the books. There's no writ of erasure that gives the federal court the authority to order a legislature to repeal a statute or instruct a state officer to erase a statute from the statutory books. So that statute will remain no matter what a federal court does. What only can be enjoined is some action of a state officer enforcing that law.
Now, back to your we departed from the thorough discussion that we had at the beginning of your argument about what I'll call a tentative standing, which I've never heard anything like that. Judge Elrod and I were on the Texas versus United States case, which was also at the preliminary injunction stage, and nobody even remotely brought up the possibility that we could consider anything other than standing as a binary a choice, not something that's tentative. But so in federal court, when a party pleads, he or she pleads the best case that he or she has in terms of what that plaintiff hopes to prove after discovery, if discovery is needed. Now, here the pleadings are the pleadings, mm-hmm. and you're telling us that there's nothing in those pleadings read in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs that can be construed as establishing standing. So I don't quite understand how it is that you say that lack of standing could be cured by discovery if it hasn't been pled. I mean, there would be no need for discovery if the pleadings are already being construed as widely as the plaintiffs have pled them.
The Supreme Court's rulings in this area are not entirely consistent. I mean, on the one hand, you have these cases like Worth against Selden and Clapper, where the Supreme Court says you need to put the allegations of standing in the complaint. You need facts. And then there are other cases like Swierkiewicz and Conley against Gibson, where the Supreme Court says the federal rules of civil procedure establish a notice pleading regime. You don't even need to plead facts. If the defendant thinks he needs more factual detail to be able to defend, he should move for a more definite statement under Rule 12b. There's tension between those cases. There's Twombly and Iqbal coming along later with this new plausibility standard. The law of pleading right now is in flux, and the Supreme Court's guidance is not entirely consistent. So we did say in our opening brief at the very end in the conclusion section that the preliminary injunction should be vacated and the case remanded with instructions to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and we made that request based on Worth against Selden and based on Clapper, where the Supreme Court dismissed complaints, affirmed the district court's dismissal of a complaint for failing to plead adequate facts on the standing inquiry. We backed away from that in our reply brief, and we just said the preliminary injunction should be vacated, because under a notice pleading regime, normally the failure to plead sufficient facts shouldn't warrant dismissal. It should warrant a more definite statement under 12e. Only if you actually plead yourself out of court should that result in the case being tossed by the district court. But again, we can line up Supreme Court decisions on both sides of this issue. And it's not entirely clear where the Supreme Court would come down in a situation like this, because sometimes the Supreme Court says dismiss for failing to allege sufficient facts. Sometimes it says don't dismiss for failing to allege sufficient facts.
So your argument is we should send it back for more findings slash pleadings slash statements on this topic. I mean, if what you're saying is it's sort of unclear, I mean, your argument before is you can't ever establish on the establishment clause absent some imminent injury. And so you think it's at least roughly similar to equal protection. And you've said nobody has pled anything imminent. And nobody showed that at the preliminary injunction hearing and declarations and so forth. If you're saying, but maybe they could, then that wouldn't be here that we would do. That would send it back and go, all right, Judge Reeves, you're develop a little bit more of a record on this issue standing and then send it back to the Fifth Circuit. That's what it sounds like you're saying.
That's not what we're asking for at all. That's not consistent with judicial economy. If that were to happen, we'd be right in front of this court again, possibly, on the merits of the Establishment Clause inquiry. All we're trying to say is a matter of candor. This is a jurisdictional question. And because it's jurisdictional, we have an obligation to present to the court the available options based on what the Supreme Court said. And the Supreme Court has not been entirely consistent on the question of fact pleading versus notice pleading on the issue of Article III standing. Worth against Selden and Clapper indicate that the facts need to be pleaded in the complaint. And if they're not pleaded in the complaint, the case needs to be thrown out. That's what the court said in those cases. There are other cases, though, from the Supreme Court that take a much more forgiving standard with respect to the issue of fact pleading and say, really all you need to do is put the defendant on notice. And then with these factual questions,
any of those cases allow us to go, but regardless of standing, you win or you lose. And
no,
I think that's the problem with that. I mean, if you want us to say, well, you didn't prove standing at the preliminary injunction stage, so we vacate the preliminary injunction, we remand it for proceedings consistent herewith, that's at least got some logic to it. But to say, well, you didn't prove standing, but if you had, we think this or that about establishment clause and this or that about equal protection. The whole point of standing, frankly, is that we want someone with a stake in it being the person to make the argument so that we're not issuing hypothetical rulings. As interesting and fascinating as that would be, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. That's really what Article III standing is about, a concrete and particularized injury, so we're sure that the plaintiff who is complaining is someone who has a stake in the outcome and isn't just coming in and giving us hypotheticals and we're all just doing the law school exam. And so if we don't have that, even if we might could someday, but we don't have that now, I don't understand why that doesn't end the matter. But I don't know. Maybe
it could. Judge Haynes, it could end the matter. Right? It's a question that's committed to this court's discretion. All we're saying, Judge Haynes, is that Steel Co. does not forbid this court to rule on whether there was a clear showing of likely success on the merits, as well as whether there was a clear showing of likely success on jurisdiction.
All right,
that's
so
all our claim is. It's a very limited claim.
On Establishment Clause, what difference, if any, other than potentially there being taxpayer standing, which you've argued doesn't exist here, what difference is there between establishing standing for equal protection purposes and establishing standing for Establishment Clause purposes?
There are some differences recognized in the Supreme Court's own case law, and one of those is the issue of taxpayer standing. Another possible distinction is whether personal confrontation with a religious symbol. The Supreme Court has said that's enough to establish standing in the Establishment Clause context. It's hard to think of an analog that would exist in equal protection because one does not encounter religious symbols typically as the basis of an equal protection claim. Those are the two main differences that I can think of.
But so if they put on a big board this statute and put it in front of the state capitol and said, proudly supporting the rights of religious people, and put this up on a big board, they might have standing because if they live around the block or go to the state capitol, would that be a different scenario?
Under the Establishment Clause, I believe they would have standing under Your Honor's hypothetical because the direct and personal contact with something that is alleged to be a religious symbol sponsored by the state is enough for Article III standing.
And that was a hypothetical as well, and we all understand.
It's a hypothetical, and they should still lose on the merits, to be sure. But as far as the Article III standing inquiry goes, if they are personally confronting a billboard sponsored by the state with what they allege to be a religious message, that's enough for standing.
But personally confronting the statute book is not confrontational enough under the law, is your position?
No, if that can't be enough for standing. If it were, everyone would have standing to challenge any law they disagree with. And that's inconsistent with many decisions of the Supreme Court, including Newdow, because Michael Newdow was not allowed to have standing to challenge the federal statute that added the phrase "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. And he couldn't say that I opened up the statute books and read the statute. That caused me offense. That wasn't enough for Article III standing there. And there are many other decisions from courts of appeals in a similar vein.
If we were assuming arguendo to agree with you that there was a lack of standing, and this is arguendo,
yes,
would we be creating a circuit split that would be problematic?
I don't think so at all. It depends on how the court writes its opinion, obviously. But the cases on which the plaintiffs have relied, such as Awad from the Tenth Circuit and Catholic League from the Ninth Circuit, are easily distinguishable, readily distinguishable.
How do you distinguish them?
Well, first, the plaintiff in Awad alleged that the Oklahoma constitutional provision would have prevented the state courts from probating his will. So that is a clear, personal, and concrete harm that goes well beyond offense taken over the law. In addition, the constitutional provision in Awad was specifically disparaging Sharia law and, by implication, the Muslim faith. In Catholic League, that was also the tone of the resolution that was challenged. It was a specific and direct disparagement of the Catholic leadership for their position on an issue. No such direct disparagement is being made in Mississippi's conscience protection law. It singles out certain beliefs for protection, but it's not going out of its way to explicitly disparage the beliefs that are not listed in Section 2. So that's the distinction. We also think Catholic League is wrongly decided for the reasons we provided in our brief, but it's not necessary for this court to create a circuit split on that question. It can simply distinguish Catholic League on the grounds that I've just described.
Okay, do you want to talk at all about the merits of this?
Certainly.
Because it seems to me that you have, and when I say merits, to be clear, I'm not talking about whether it was a good idea or bad idea to pass a statute, because that isn't our business. Our business is solely whether it's constitutional or not. If we get past the standing and find that there is standing, then that's our only question. We can't get into whether this was a good idea. If it was constitutional, Mississippi can do it. If it's not constitutional, even if it's a good idea or if it's a bad idea, they can't do it. So I just want to be clear on that. I have a question about, on both establishment and equal protection, this idea that this is not discriminating against people, it's simply protecting religious beliefs. And you have somebody who goes to get a marriage license and they walk up to the counter and says, you know, I'm marrying Jane, and so we would like our license. And the clerk goes, I'm recused, and goes running down the hall and has to find, let me go see if there's anyone who will give you a license. To me, I'm not sure why that isn't state-sponsored discrimination.
Well, that's not permitted under the statute. The statute requires
because that person's recusing, and let's say they've given the proper notice or whatever.
If
there's
the clerk,
nothing that says they can't say why they're recusing and can't say it in a real loudly, like, I have to recuse me. There's nothing that prevents that.
That's not permitted under the statute. If a clerk or any state employee is recused, the issuance of a marriage license cannot be delayed in any manner. So even under Your Honor's hypothetical, that is a delay if the clerk is going to make a scene, run down the hall, and say, I'm recused. Steps must be taken to prevent that from happening under the terms of the statute. Now, if this were to happen, if what Your Honor has described were to happen for some reason, there would be Article III injury, certainly. Encountering that type of scenario at the county courthouse is an Article III injury, and it would give the person who encountered that clerk standing to challenge the law. Now, whether it succeeds on the merits is a separate question, but what Your Honor described is not what the statute protects.
Okay. Providing goods and services related to the solemnization, formation, celebration, or recognition of any marriage. Isn't allowing people to fail to recognize a marriage that the Supreme Court has expressly held must be permitted an attempt to overrule the United States Supreme Court?
No, not at all. All the Supreme Court holds is that a state is required to recognize and license marriages between the same sex. A private actor is not the state. Private actors' decisions do not implicate the 14th Amendment. There's no fundamental right.
The state government is not allowed to take any action relating to someone refusing to recognize a marriage, and that's involving the state in declining in somebody's... We're not talking about, like, I won't open my door to someone who I don't recognize one way or the other. We're talking about the state permitting that. So why isn't that involving the state in a non-recognition of a marriage that the U.S. Supreme Court has said has to be recognized?
That theory of state action would make every act that occurs within a state borders state action, because the state is either allowing it to occur or failing to prevent it from happening. And there are some laws.
A statute that expressly allows the state to bless that non-recognition.
Bless is an overstatement, Judge Haynes. The state is allowing it to occur without penalty or reprisal from the state. That's not a blessing. It's just the state failing to punish or discriminate or take adverse action against those people who act in a manner in accordance with their conscience. The state is not, for example, complicit in the consumption of peyote if they exempt followers of the native religion from using peyote as part of their religious ceremonies. That's not state action. This is not state action either.
Is it important to the constitutionality of the statute that it contains the conscientious objector status, not just for religious objection, but also for sincerely held beliefs, secular sincerely held beliefs? Is that essential or important or neither here nor there?
Yeah. May I answer? My time has expired.
Of course.
We don't believe that's outcome determinative, Judge Elrod. We think it helps our defense of the law at the margins, but it certainly would not make the law unconstitutional if it were limited to religious exemptions. For example, the peyote exemptions that are discussed in the Peyote Way Church of God case. Those exemptions were limited to people who ingested peyote explicitly for religious reasons. They were upheld by this court, and properly so, in our view. If this statute were hypothetically limited to religious objectors, it would be equally constitutional.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you.
You've saved time for rebuttal. Kathleen?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I represent the CSE plaintiffs, and my clients have brought only an Establishment Clause claim, and for that reason, I'm going to be focusing on the Establishment Clause. One of my clients is Susan Rostowski, an Episcopal vicar from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Although Reverend Rostowski couldn't be here because of the storms that have been plaguing Mississippi in the last 48 hours, I want to be perfectly clear about something at the outset. My clients acknowledge and respect that there are many different people with different but equally sincere religious beliefs about marriage in general and about marriage between same-sex couples in particular. I am not here today to tell you that such beliefs can never be accommodated under the First Amendment. In fact, my clients believe that in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Employment Division versus Smith, neutral religious exemption laws play a vital role in the preservation of religious liberty in this country. And in fact, many states throughout this nation, such as Maine or Utah, have been experimenting with religious accommodation laws pertaining to LGBT issues, with thoughtful people on both sides seeking to forge fair and constitutional compromises in good faith. But we are not here today to talk in general about the conflicts that can arise between sincerely held religious beliefs and the constitutional right recognized by the Supreme Court in Obergefell. We are here today to talk about a specific statute, HB 1523, which is completely inconsistent with our country's history and constitutional practice regarding religious liberty. Unlike any other religious accommodation statute of which we are aware, HB 1523 begins with the endorsement of three specific religious beliefs, and then, based upon those beliefs, permits what I call the kitchen sink approach, an extremely broad and open-ended range of exemptions in conduct. If there is one thing that the Establishment Clause says the government cannot do, this is it.
Okay, let me ask you about this three specific religious beliefs, because isn't there a what can happily a raging controversy even within denominations, the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopalian Church, the Methodist Church, that there's not There's not a raging controversy, let's say, within the Methodist Church about whether Jesus Christ was the Son of God. Okay, that's an agreed upon tenet overall in that faith. But there is a raging controversy in many denominations within the Christian Church and elsewhere in other religions, other faiths, over this issue. And so how can you say it's a religious belief when even the ministers and so forth can't agree on this principle?
I would go, yes, I understand, Your Honor. I would go back to our nation's history and to what the framers were concerned about when they passed the First Amendment. In the colonial period, there also were intense debates within Christian sects, within Protestant sects, and between Protestant sects about issues back at that time about taking oaths, about having taxes to support a government church, about Native Americans. And it didn't matter whether the debate was within Methodism, for example, or between Methodists and Presbyterians. The First Amendment and the Establishment Clause covers both. What you're looking at in the Establishment Clause context, in the words of Justice O'Connor, that was adopted by the court in Santa Fe, is what a reasonable observer, how a reasonable observer would perceive the statute or the enactment in the context in which it was passed. And there is no way that a reasonable observer in the state of Mississippi could construe this statute any other way other than the explicit endorsement of certain religious beliefs. What the statute does is it says to certain people in Mississippi, you are outsiders. You are not part of the political community, like my client, Reverend Rostowski. And it says to other people in Mississippi, you are insiders. You are the favored people.
What religion is being established by this section?
The religion, it's not necessarily a religion. It doesn't have to be establishment of religion. It's establishment of religious belief. Just as creationism in the Louisiana cases, the court said you couldn't force creationism to be taught in the schools. Creationism is associated with a whole bunch of religions. But the forcing of the teaching of creationism was an endorsement of a religious belief. The same exact thing is true here. We don't need to rely.
Creationism is saying God created the world, and that
Correct.
Is a religious belief.
Correct.
Regardless of which religion holds it.
Correct.
However, there are people who think same-sex marriage is not a good idea who hold no particular religious faith, just as there are people of a religious faith, like your client, the Reverend, who believe same-sex marriage is not outside of God's plan, if you will.
That is correct, Your Honor. But again, what the Supreme Court test requires you to do is to look at what a reasonable person would think about whether this statute is sending a message. We can get to standing, but the constitutional injury for Establishment Clause is the government sending a message. And what message do people in Mississippi think the government was sending? A message about religious beliefs. And indeed, when you're looking at this inquiry, unlike in other contexts, there is no debate within the Supreme Court about whether legislative history is admissible. It clearly is. In fact, Justice Souter has said in McCreary that not looking at legislative history in this context would be disingenuous, because you have to look at the context of the statute. And not only can you look at it as a reasonable observer, but as a matter of fact, we know exactly how this statute was perceived in Mississippi. Your Honor this morning used the phrase Twitterverse. The Twitterverse, in response to the enactment of the statute, was all about religious beliefs against gay people and against same-sex marriage. There was no one talking about this statute being motivated by some kind of secular policy reason other than religious liberty in support of the statute.
Is that something we should consider? Is that something we should consider? You know, whenever laws protecting LGBT rights have passed, people have also, prominent people have said, we do this because we're loving. We do this, and they have cited Bible verses. But you wouldn't argue that those are religious, that because the people citing those and cited Bible verses, that was a religious statute. Do you say, 20 times more Twitter said Bible verses versus over there?
You don't need to go to that, Your Honor. You have the statute itself, which says religious belief, I think, 34 times. You have every person who supported the statute, including the governor, including the legislature, saying the purpose of the statute was to promote these religious beliefs and to protect people with these religious beliefs.
Does it say it was to promote those religious beliefs, or does it say it was to protect people who pursue those beliefs?
It was to protect people who pursue those religious beliefs, but there was no one, zero people saying that we are promoting the statute because of some secular policy reason, which you're not even hearing from the other side, other than the protection of these religious beliefs.
Does it matter that the statute itself contains a secular exception? I asked the other side the same question.
The answer is it can, but the answer also, in Establishment Clause terminology, the phrase that's used is sham. And if the court concludes that the words moral conviction in the statute are a sham, just as it concluded in Wallace v. Jaffrey, because Wallace v. Jaffrey, they already had a moment of silence statute for the school system, and then they passed another statute. The court concludes, just as here you have a Mississippi RFRA, A, you have a Mississippi RFRA, B, you have the lawyers on the other side saying the statute doesn't do anything. I'm happy to answer the questions about what the statute actually does. But if they're right and the statute doesn't do anything, then all it does is send a message about three specific religious beliefs. We've never had a statute that has ever done this in our constitutional history. The Utah statute doesn't do it. The Maine statute doesn't do it. The supporters of the First Amendment Defense Act, even they admit it's unconstitutional because they've removed this non-neutrality language from their bill.
Well, let's get back then to the standing inquiry that we've already spent a lot of time on. So tell us what there is in your pleadings that establishes concrete injury in fact.
So I think the answer on Establishment Clause standing is, again, and Judge Higginson explained this very well last Friday, is you have to look at the nature of the injury. For equal protection, the nature of the injury is unequal treatment. For an Establishment Clause violation, the constitutional injury is when the government speaks, it sends a message to certain people, certain religious people or non-religious people, that they are outsiders, and to other religious people that they are insiders. And the Supreme Court has been very clear that it's the injury that causes the problem. It's the government speaking that causes the injury. So you have basically two kinds of, again, part of the problem is no one has passed a statute like this before, but you have two kinds of Establishment Clause endorsement cases. You have the display cases, where someone looks at your case in Murray is the perfect example, sees a small cross in the city of Austin seal on a police car or something like that, and that's enough to establish standing. Or you have the school prayer cases. And the school prayer cases are crucial in this regard because we look to see whether any plaintiff had been held to have standing in a school prayer case before there was ever a school prayer. And what's the answer? Yes. In the Santa Fe case, the Supreme Court, in response to the argument that it was an improper facial challenge, had this to say. They said, the mere passage by the district of a policy that has the purpose and perception of government establishment of a religion is enough to create a facial challenge. It's exactly the same as a standing argument being made here. And they further went on to say, not only is the simple enactment of this policy with the purpose and perception of school endorsement enough, but, and I'm going to read this specifically, we need not wait for the inevitable to confirm and magnify the constitutional injury. So exactly what my friend on the other side was saying is that you have to wait till there's some kind of concrete Establishment Clause injury. The Supreme Court said exactly the opposite. My clients have been hurt enough. They have testified in court that a message has been conveyed to them that they are outsiders in their own home state. And unlike Valley Forge, they don't have to travel anywhere. They're not roaming in search of a constitutional violation. The constitutional violation came to their own homes and backyards.
But isn't any conscience protection statute something that will prefer a particular conscience over another? So are pacifists preferred over the people who enlisted in the army? Are peyote users in the Native American faith, a Native American faith, preferred over people whose faith does not involve using peyote, et cetera? I mean, there's a lot of conscience protection statutes out there, and could you make that same argument on all of them?
No, so let me explain why.
Okay.
So there are two kinds of really conscience-based or free exercise-based exemption statutes. There's ones that Judge Elrod wrote about in the Santeria case, where there are narrow exemptions that tend to deal almost exclusively with matters of ceremonial religious practice. In New York, we have issues with Orthodox Jews, and there are a number of statutes or cases that allow Orthodox Jews to follow their practices, and it's not a violation. Why? Because it's not sending the message The Santeria practices are government permitting Santeria practices is not sending a message to anyone that Santeria is the preferred religious belief in Texas or Mississippi or Louisiana. That's
why is that? Is that just because it's small?
It's because of the context of the statute, the context of the society, all these things which the Supreme Court has said you are to look at in this context.
So, but could one argue that in this changing culture that the number of people who are people who have an orthodox view of biblical prohibitions in the Book of Romans or something, I'm trying to make a hypothetical, that those are becoming a smaller and smaller group of people, and in fact you can't get one of the good law firms that file all these amicus briefs are not filing briefs for them. So maybe in the context they're a small group too, like the Santerians, because people are afraid to say those things in public.
Your Honor,
is that possible?
That may be true with respect to another statute, but with all due respect, not true for the state of Mississippi. Just not true for the state of Mississippi, based on the legislative record, the statements of the governor that he would be crucified to support this statute.
So if this was in Austin or New York, then this argument wouldn't work, here?
Let me go to the second thing, because I think that's what it deals with. There are, I said at the outset, there can be religious accommodation statutes relating to people's views about LGBT marriage equality that are constitutional. I'm not saying that that's impossible.
Okay,
the problem is this statute.
How does this need to be changed in your view?
Okay.
What would make this, the concept here, I think, if we're going to understand the argument the state is making, is there is a concern that people whose faith says one man, one woman, are going to be forced into supporting a wedding that is not something that comports with their beliefs. That's what the state is arguing is the purpose of this, among other things. But we'll just focus on the weddings because that seems like the easiest hypothetical, if you will. If you accept that protecting the conscience of people is something that can be done by a state, how could they do that constitutionally?
Okay. So there are two things that are obvious constitutional violations with the statute. The first one, I think, takes care of the case. You don't need to go beyond it. The first one is the non-neutrality. The Supreme Court has said countless times, dozens of times, that neutrality is the underlying principle of both the free exercise and the Establishment Clauses of the First Amendment. This statute cannot be read by anyone as a neutral statute as to religious beliefs.
If subsection A of section 2, instead of saying that this the belief that marriage is or should be recognized as a union of one man and one woman, said that is the belief about whether marriage is or should be recognized. In other words, somebody has a belief one way or the other.
Yeah, the Utah Compromise, for example, which has not been challenged, says religious views about marriage, sexuality, and gender, I think, is the language. So it's neutral. You could have religious view on one side or religious view on the other.
And those would all be protected.
And it certainly solves the neutrality problem.
But if you passed a statute like that, would that then allow the clerk not to issue the license, the judge not to perform the wedding, the cake baker not to bake the cake?
So let me go to the next problem with the statute, is that it has this kitchen sink approach. So some subsections of the statute, if you solve the neutrality problem, could potentially be constitutional. On the clerk issue, my clients first sought discovery before they did anything else about what kinds of bells and suspenders were going to be put in place by the state of Mississippi, because the statute just says impediment and delay, to make sure that the hypothetical that you postulated, Judge Haynes, would never happen. It's not fair to have to say to a gay couple, go to, you know, close your eyes, cross your fingers, say a prayer, and hope it doesn't happen to you. You can't put a couple at that risk. We wanted to make sure that it wouldn't happen. And it's at least possible that if those belts and suspenders were in place, that could be constitutional. The problem with this statute is it goes far beyond that. And that's where it distinguishes it from the abortion context. In the abortion religious exemption statutes, you know going in, the legislature knew going in, exactly what someone could or could not do in connection with the procedure of performing an abortion. People have very strong religious beliefs about that. They believe it to be murder. That's understandable. It's a huge imposition on religious exercise. And you know exactly what someone can or can't do. With this statute, with the kind of kitchen sink approach to the subsections, throwing a whole bunch of different stuff in, there are certain sections, and you've kind of alluded to this, where it is impossible to know, sitting here today, how it could arise, what people could do, whether a clerk could yell at someone like that. I don't think that's disposed of in the statute at all. Whether a public school teacher could make similar comments to a class of 7-year-old kids in a public school and not be disciplined or be removed from the class as a result, all of that is permissible. And if you have that kind of a broad RFRA type statute, a broad-based religious exemption statute, that's where you need to have the balancing.
Now you,
that's where you need to look at the three-party harms. Excuse me, Judge.
You referenced the Moore case from last week.
Yes.
And I understand that that's an equal protection, not a First Amendment challenge, but you used the phrase earlier, sends a message. Why does sends a message work for equal protection but not for establishment or free exercise?
Well, the opposite. It works for establishment and not equal protection. Right. I mean, the nature of the injury for establishment clause is the government sending an official message. And let me talk about that for a second.
Are you saying that the Moore case is not about sending a message?
The injury for equal protection is some kind of governmental enforced unequal treatment. So you have to look at what the constitutional provision guards against or protects against. For establishment clause, it's sending a message by the government. And for equal protection, it's treating people differently without either a rational basis or depending upon the level of scrutiny. Now, with respect to this issue about the question you asked, Judge Allred, about the big banner on the Mississippi State Capitol that just had this statute in it, I can't imagine how the government can send a more clear message about religious preferences with respect to these issues than by passing this kind of a statute. That is how the government sends messages. The fact of the matter is I can't give you a case that does it because no government has ever tried to pass this kind of statute in the past. But if in the school context, the plaintiff had standing to challenge the school prayer in Santa Fe before the prayer was ever said, my clients.
But the prayer was going to be said where the person had to be. I mean, that seems to be the link with, like, I don't have children in school. And so if there was in my hometown, if there was a law passed about prayer in the school, I don't think I would have standing, whether I agreed with it or not. I don't think I would have standing because nobody in my, I'm not going to be having to listen to a prayer and neither is anybody I'm related to. So why does that prove anything here?
Two things. The critically unconstitutional provision in HB 1523 is Section 2. The rest of the statute flows from it. It begins with those religious beliefs. That's the government sending the message. And again, my religious, it's kind of funny, my religious tradition teaches that you can hurt someone with words, frankly, a lot more than you can with pictures. And the words in Section 2 have caused stigmatic injury to my clients. They testify that it has. And as the Supreme Court said in Santa Fe, you don't have to wait for more stigmatic injury. That's enough for Establishment Clause standing.
Let me ask you on this procedural discussion that we had with counsel opposite, if we were to conclude against your argument that you had not established standing, maybe someday there is somebody who would be denied a service who would have standing, so we're not saying ever in a day, but that at the current posture there's not, what procedurally should happen if we were to conclude, contrary to your argument, that none of the plaintiffs have standing on any of the claims? What are we supposed to do?
So in my normal practice, I practice commercial law, and so I deal with the rules of civil procedure all the time. And I'm familiar with these kinds of government, the difficulties between the Supreme Court, what they said in Iqbal and Twombly, and what they said in Conley, and what they said in Worth v. Selden. And I agree with my friend sitting to my left that there is confusion in the case law. But I think the answer on a preliminary injunction is pretty well established, is if you conclude that there's no standing, A, you don't reach the merits, as I think you've already talked about, and B, you would send it back, particularly if you think that there was a problem with the pleadings. You would send it back to allow the plaintiffs to further develop the record as to the pleadings. Again, I don't think you would need to allege that kind of standing, that kind of injury that's already happened for the Establishment Clause. I should also say that Bowen v. Kendrick, the Supreme Court says, again, that facial challenges in the Establishment Clause context are the norm, and that the court has frequently permitted there to be standing in a facial challenge before the whatever the issue was, the prayer, school prayer, or whatever it was, went into effect.
Well, but Mr. Mitchell, if I heard him correctly, didn't talk about going back to amend pleadings. I had asked him a couple of questions about that. He says it goes back for discovery. Tell us how that would work, if it worked, and what discovery. I mean, do you think after discovery, your pleadings would be properly amended to be more specific?
Under
Rule 8 and notice pleading.
Yeah, we certainly would do our best. I'll give you an example, Your Honor. So we.
But I mean, you must have facts that you know about or that you suspect that you could establish through further discovery. Otherwise, you could not have, in good faith, brought the case. So tell us how that would develop if we followed.
So for example,
Mr. Mitchell's.
So, scenario. For example, this was a preliminary injunction hearing, and it was done, as Your Honors probably know, on a very expedited schedule. And we put on testimony from one of the witnesses who lived in Mississippi that she had a good friend of hers had a daughter who was 7 years old who went to the public schools. And in this daughter's class, the second grade or first grade teacher went around and said to each kid, who are your parents and are they married? This little girl raised her hand and said, yes, I have two moms and they're married. The teacher then said, no, they're not. Your parents are not married. And then polled the rest of the students to show this girl that all their other male female parents were properly married in contrast to hers. Would we add parties like that as plaintiffs to this action? That was not objected to on hearsay grounds, by the way. Would we add parties like that if the court were to rule? We most assuredly would. And that happened. Here's the difference between the statute. What happened in that story is the teacher was reassigned from this girl's class. If that happened under HB 1523, that teacher could not be reassigned. If she were reassigned, she would have a suit against the state of Mississippi for an injunction and potentially monetary damages. Your Honors, I implore you, do not put that 7-year-old child at the risk of that kind of indignity. The Supreme Court precedents say you do not need that kind of harm for the Establishment Clause. The harm is the sending of the message. Stigmatic injury is paradigmatic injury in the context of the Establishment Clause. And again, I'm not saying that's true for any other part of the Constitution.
Ms. Kaplan?
Is Santa Fe your strongest case for the what is your strongest case?
Santa Fe is the strongest case, but Bowen also cites a number of other cases that have said similar things. Again, I don't have a statute that I can cite that has sent this kind of stigmatic injury to people in a state the way this statute has. It's never been tried before.
Ms. Kaplan, on the existing record, do you agree or concede that stigma is what you have on the existing record? I'm not going to find buried in somebody's testimony something beyond the stigma. And I'm not saying that that's not good enough. I'm just saying that is what you stand on here
today.
Two
other kinds of testimony in addition to that, Your Honor, if it helps. One, there was testimony that merely, and this goes to how things were perceived in Mississippi, merely upon the enactment of the statute, gay men in the north of Mississippi, I believe it's the Delta, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty certain it's the Delta, gay men in the Delta have been afraid to go out for dinner together in public because they were afraid that they would be confronted or kicked out of restaurants, et cetera, and humiliated merely upon the enactment of the statute. In addition, my client, who's a CSE member, Josie Pritchett, testified. She had been a plaintiff in the marriage case. She had run for office in Mississippi. She lived her whole entire life in Mississippi. She had two kids. And she testified that she and her wife moved from Mississippi, despite all their family and connections there and their love of Mississippi, to Tampa, Florida, excuse me, because the passage of HB 1523 sent a message to her that she could not raise her children in the state of Mississippi without putting them to the harm of this kind of stigmatic and other injuries.
But how do you deal with the redressability problem then? If the statute would still be there even if we agree with you?
If this court issues an order, just as happened with, frankly, with the same-sex adoption case in Mississippi, if this court issues an order that HB 1523 constitutes an improper endorsement of religious beliefs in stark violation, I would say radical violation of the neutrality principles that underlie these provisions, that will cure the stigma. That will cure the injury. Because just like the Twitter universe that you talked about before, Judge Haynes, I can tell you that instantaneously, every gay person, indeed every non-gay person in Mississippi, will know of that ruling.
All right, thank you, Ms. Kaplan. Mr. McDuff?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. My clients raise both Establishment Clause and Equal Protection Clause claims, and I just want to add a couple of things regarding the Establishment Clause issue and then move to Equal Protection. The Establishment Clause says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Of course, that now applies to state governments as well. And Judge Smith, you asked the hypothetical about what if the Mississippi legislature passed a law establishing a religion, specifically the Southern Baptist religion. And counsel for the governor said that by itself would not give standing to those who disagreed with that law. And then in response to Judge Elrod's question, he said, well, maybe if there was a big board in front of the Capitol, that would be enough to establish standing if a person actually saw the board. And surely, with respect to the First Amendment, standing doesn't turn on whether there's a big board you read the law on or a piece of paper or a computer. A federal court can declare such a law unconstitutional, and it can enjoin its implementation so that it is not effective as law, even if there's nothing else to be done under the statute other than simply the passage of it, respecting an establishment of religion. And
what
I think,
case says that?
I'm sorry?
What case says that, Counselor?
I don't know that there's any case that says that, because this is a unique statute, just as a statute being passed that said Southern Baptism or the Southern Baptist religion is the official religion of Mississippi.
But
I think,
of course, Mr. Mitchell says, well, you take action against a statute like that by enjoining a state officer, but that by the mere existence of the words in a one-sentence statute, there's nothing to enjoin, and there's no injury in fact, or no redressability, because there's no action to take.
Well, with every statute, as with this one, there's going to be an implementation date. Maybe it's immediate, maybe it's a month later. A federal court can enjoin implementation of that statute, even if it doesn't command any officer to do anything. That means it is no longer effective as law. And so that the citizens of Mississippi, going forward, know there's not a law saying that the Southern Baptist religion is their official religion.
So what is the concrete and particularized injury of somebody in the face of such a statute?
It is the stigma of having
so
their state.
Stigmatic, I mean, back to kind of Judge
sure.
Owen's point, that's what you all, with your co-counsel, what you have is that by, in your view, establishing a religion, there is a stigma to people that are not adherents of that religion.
That's right. By the endorsement,
so
exactly.
And
exactly.
The law is Southern Baptist, then that's the stigma. You feel that your religion has been singled out or not become part of the in crowd, if you will.
Precisely.
That's the argument. Okay,
precisely.
So that's enough to confer standing. And who says that? What case says that? You think
well, I think Ms. Kaplan correctly cited the Santa Fe case.
Okay.
That said the passage is the unconstitutional act. Now, granted,
but in the Santa Fe case, didn't they already have, they had a written down prayer, didn't they? I thought they had the statement and the principal had seen it. Maybe I'm confusing it with one of the other prayer cases out of that circumstance. But
well, that's the case that involved prayers at the high school football game.
At the football game, right. But I thought that there was already,
right.
They were going to the school administrator, the students were going and to the school administrators, and similar to like at the graduation cases where you had to go to the school administrators.
It was a football prayer, and when the violation of the Establishment Clause is a prayer, or is a placard, or is a cross, or is the teaching of a course on creationism, the courts have held that, yes, there has to be a physical encounter with it. But here, when you're just talking about a statute that establishes a religion, and there's not going to be further physical manifestation of it, it surely is enough of an encounter to read the statute.
But did you say that you were still advancing your equal protection claims?
Yes.
How is that the case after the Moore case?
Because unlike the Moore case,
because that it pretty much says, doesn't it, that stigma is not
stigma by
doesn't its, work.
Stigma by itself doesn't work, but stigma flowing from unequal treatment clearly does.
But what unequal treatment do you have so far? I'm not saying you couldn't have unequal treatment, but what in this record says that there has been unequal treatment by the governmental entity in the specific circumstance?
The unequal treatment is, to quote the 14th Amendment, the unequal protection of the laws. I mean, the 14th Amendment says no state shall deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And unlike the Moore case, which involved a flag, and unlike Allen versus Wright, which involved a tax exemption for segregated private schools that also was granted to integrated schools, this statute specifically provides for unequal treatment and the unequal protection of the law specifically.
But then wouldn't it seem that you could find someone that would be able to, for example, Mr. Taylor, he did not say, as I understand it, that he's fixing to get married in Mississippi and his fear is going to order the cake or the wedding hall or whatever, or the judge has refused to perform the service or whatever. And so wouldn't it seem like you could find someone and should find someone that is an imminent harm, if you will, of encountering such discrimination as you envision this law would permit.
But that's not necessary for this reason. The statute sets out protections for the people who are adherents to these specific beliefs that are not provided to people who are non-adherents, and more importantly...
Yeah, but that's your establishment. I'm talking about on the equal protection.
Yes.
The concern here, it seems to me, is the whole intersection of free exercise and public accommodations. And this came up a lot, and I know people don't want to make the analogy, but this came up a lot during the Civil Rights era, where people didn't want to accommodate somebody, and they claimed a religious exemption, and that didn't end up working too well.
Right.
And so that's the argument. But as I understand it, in those situations, there were people going to a lunch counter and not being served. I mean, there wasn't an imagined potential problem. There was a problem.
Right.
And that was dealt with by saying, you can have whatever beliefs you want to have, but you can't transmit those beliefs into a denial of public accommodations. And that was how that whole line of situations transpire. So as we come here, wouldn't it seem that Mr. Taylor, if he's about to get married in Mississippi, could have told us that and could have said, look, I don't know what contract rights I have if I sign up with a cake baker, because they can at the last minute decide they're not going to bake the cake and I don't have any remedy because it would violate 1523 to sue this person.
Well, he is getting married in Mississippi, and I mean reading the pleadings as most favorably to the plaintiff, he is a Mississippian. He said he was going to get married. And I think it's pretty easy to establish he's going to get married in Mississippi.
Sure. I mean,
but the more important,
he got married in Florida, so I don't know that the fact that you're getting married means you're getting married in the state you live in.
But he is, and at any rate, the point, Judge Haynes, is that the danger is there just from the fact of the statute, the fact that you said maybe he should say that he's worried that a cake maker is going to back out on the contract. That possibility exists simply because of the statute itself.
And but did you allege discriminatory treatment in the pleading? And if so, where is that in your pleading?
We alleged that the statute provides unequal protection of the laws and
unequal
treatment in that sense.
But you don't allege any specific discriminatory treatment?
We don't allege that a specific person is about to be denied a cake.
I'm reading
or
from
flowers.
Judge Hickinson's case. It says, Allen held that when plaintiffs ground their equal protection injuries in stigmatic harm, they only have standing if they also allege discriminatory treatment. And then it goes on. They're trying to distinguish Allen in this context. They do first the argument that, well, just the state blessing this in some way in the Confederate flag, and that's enough. And then they reject that argument, and then they go through the Allen argument. So is your pleading lacking?
No, I don't think so, because I think here the unequal treatment is the unequal protection of the law, and the law specifically provides protection to the believers to allow them to discriminate against the people in these particular groups without any consequence from the state whatsoever.
Views on marriage or views on whether marriage is or should be recognized as a union, one man and one marriage. So that would encompass somebody whose religious faith says it is appropriate and is proper to have same-sex marriage. All right, in that case, you still could have, Mr. Taylor could still suffer the exact same deprivation of a cake or a wedding hall or whatever, and yet you would agree that 2A would then be neutral.
It would be neutral if it covered all religious objections to marriages, whether it's same sex, whether it's interfaith, whether it's divorced people.
In that circumstance, Mr. Taylor could still have this exact same problem, even though it would now be neutral, in that he encounters a cake baker, a florist, a photographer who refuses to perform services for his wedding because of this belief.
Sure, but that would not be the result of a statute that provides unequal protection of the laws by designating same-sex couples as the people against whom the believers can discriminate without any fear of consequence from the state.
Instead, the statute
would apply to all people who have religious objections to marriages. There may be another problem with it, but it's not an equal protection problem.
Does this statute also discriminate against non-same-sex couples, opposite-sex couples, who participate in sexual activity?
Oh, it does. The unmarried. Unmarried people who engage in sexual intimacy are also one of the targeted groups in the statute. And so, we have one client who is an unmarried person engaged in sexual intimacy. I want to read to you from the decision. It's quoted in our brief in the Northeast Florida contractors case. It says, when the government erects a barrier that makes it more difficult for members of one group to obtain a benefit than it is for members of another group, a member of the former group seeking to challenge the barrier need not allege that he would have obtained the benefit but for the barrier in order to establish standing. The injury, in fact, in an equal protection case of this variety is the denial of equal treatment resulting from the imposition of the barrier, not the ultimate inability to obtain the benefit. And the benefit...
But in that case, wasn't there an important factual distinction that there were just a limited number of available contracts, so it was a lot easier to see a concrete injury, whereas the number of potential plaintiffs in the same circumstance as your clients is almost limitless.
Well, the facts were different, but here's the key point: the benefit that the lesbian and gay and transgender plaintiffs and the unmarried plaintiff engaged in sexual intimacy. The benefit they seek is to be free of discrimination, to avoid discrimination. And this statute, by authorizing discrimination specifically against them, but discrimination based on religious beliefs that would condemn them as being sinful, but not against religious beliefs that involve other types of marriages, that is a structural obstacle that denies them the benefit that they seek.
Those people are then declining to do artistic, this is their position, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. Their position is they're declining to create art that supports something they don't agree with. And those people have been told you can either shut down your business or you can provide the cake and so forth that you don't agree with. What is your answer to that line of cases?
Well, I think the answer is the one that the Mississippi legislature adopted in 2004, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, where any time someone who has a sincerely held religious belief regarding something like a marriage or anything else can object to any action of the government, for example, if they were to be brought to court because they didn't provide a cake, and unless there was a compelling interest in forcing them to act contrary to that belief, and it was the least restrictive means of doing so, then the person's religious objection would be upheld. And again, the thing about the 2014 Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Mississippi, like the others throughout the states, is it does not discriminate on the basis of same-sex relationships or transgender or anything else. It applies to all religious beliefs. And that's the problem with this particular statute, and that's why it is an unequal protection of the laws, because it allows same-sex couples to be targeted in a way that no other couples are. And it allows transgender people to be targeted.
And unmarried.
And
sexually
exactly.
Active. So does it just target everybody?
No.
I mean, is that
no? It targets. It targets those three groups. And the adding of one.
Who?
And the adding of the latter group does not detract from the fact that it targets the others. And so the stigma in an equal protection clause has to flow from unequal treatment, or again, to use the words of the 14th Amendment, unequal protection of the laws. And by singling out the same-sex couples, as well as the other groups, the state of Mississippi is treating them as unequal.
I thought there was a statistic somewhere, and I may be wrong, that the people in Section 2B, it's like 90% or something of all heterosexual couples. If that's the case, then everybody essentially is being stigmatized, and only a very small percentage of people in Mississippi fit in the ABC group. And so in that case, does that change the analysis at all?
No.
Arguendo that I'm correct on the statistic. I know there was a statistic of a very high percentage of people engage in sexual activity prior to marriage.
No, but
if that's so, then how can you say it's stigmatizing a small group if it's essentially stigmatizing a very large percentage?
Well, it still stigmatizes same-sex couples
along with the people in B.
Yes, but the important purposes, the important analysis for purposes of the same-sex plaintiffs is that they are stigmatized. They are the only ones who, under this statute, can be discriminated against without any fear of consequence from the state. And I'm going to quote from the Windsor case, that sends a message that their marriages are less worthy than the marriages of others.
Because, no, I get that. I mean, I completely understand that. But I'm saying if you're also stigmatizing people who engaged in sexual relations before they were married, and you're also stigmatizing the transgender group as well, you haven't left a lot of people, is what I'm saying. Does that make any difference
No.
to the analysis? analysis at all. If a majority of people in the state are stigmatized or a minority of people in the state are stigmatized, does that make any difference to the analysis?
No, because the question for equal protection purposes is how is each group of plaintiffs treated? And the same-sex couples are treated under the law very different than opposite-sex couples, couples who are divorced, couples who are interfaith. And whatever you think about the unmarried sexual intimacy and whether that's constitutional or unconstitutional, it's pretty clear that the portion of the statute giving less protection or giving no protection to same-sex couples, giving extra protection to those who would contend them as sinful and discriminate against them, does violate the equal protection of the laws. It is unequal treatment, and the stigma flows from it that declares that sends the message that their marriages are less worthy than other marriages. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I saw the red light go off.
Have to use all your time, but you surely
may. I have one more point I want to, actually two more points I want to make very briefly.
Okay.
And the first is, Judge Smith, in your opinion on remand after Obergefell in the same-sex marriage case in Mississippi, you talked there about the 14th Amendment iteration of Obergefell, and you quoted from the Supreme Court's opinion where the court said that same-sex marriages, that same-sex couples are entitled to join in civil marriage, quote, on the same terms and conditions as opposite-sex couples, end quote. And the court in Obergefell also said that same-sex couples are entitled to, quote, equal dignity in the eyes of the law, end quote. And this statute, by announcing that people can discriminate against same-sex couples, but not against, without consequence from the state, but not against opposite-sex couples, puts them on different terms, than puts same-sex couples on different terms, and it does deny them equal dignity in the eyes of the law. And the law itself encompasses that unequal treatment and encompasses that unequal protection, and there's no need to show any further injury, no need to allow the law to take effect, because the injury is clear and the resulting stigma is clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDuff. Mr. Mitchell, you've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Mitchell, Mr. McDuff, in his brief for the Barber plaintiffs, accurately referred us to the amicus brief by the state of Texas and others that referred to a, quote, actual threat, close quote, of a situation arising in which a business owner denies services to a same-sex couple. Obviously, you're not bound by anything that amici say in what they filed in this court, but let me ask you whether you agree with the characterization that there is an actual threat. I'm, of course, thinking of the standing issue when I bring that to your attention.
I'm sorry, to understand your question, an actual threat to the potential customers of people who...
Well, the actual threat of a situation arising in which a business owner denies services to a same-sex couple. I'm just reading from page 30 of Mr. McDuff's brief, and of course I went back to the amicus brief, and he did correctly quote those words, that there is here an actual threat. And I'm asking whether that's sufficient to confer standing, or at least a colorable argument that would confer standing. If it is an actual threat, you may tell us that it's not, and that the state of Texas was inaccurate in phrasing it that way.
I need to see the full context of the statement in the brief. I'm sorry. I from what I recall, Texas was trying to argue that there is an actual threat to the owners of those businesses, a threat of government reprisal or persecution for them acting in accordance with their conscience and declining to participate in conduct that they regard as either sacrilegious or immoral. That was my understanding of the Texas amicus. It was telling anecdotes of individual entrepreneurs who faced reprisals.
Well,
the threat was to them, not to them.
But that still suggests that there is an actual threat of an incident occurring in which someone wishes to utilize.
Absolutely. There is a possibility of that, but that's not enough for standing. It's not enough for them to show there's a threat that it might happen to someone. They have to show that that someone is one of these plaintiffs.
I thought a lot of standing cases refer to the concept of actual threat, perhaps not using those exact words, as being enough, as being more than just theorizing that something might possibly happen in the future.
There needs to be a substantial risk or a certainly impending injury to one of these actual plaintiffs in this case. The fact that it might happen somewhere in the United States to some person is not enough. And Judge Smith, even if there were an actual threat, they still need to show that that threat would be caused by this statute. And they can't make that showing because this conduct was legal. It was legal in Mississippi before House Bill 1523. Except possibly in Jackson, depending.
About Jackson. The hard part to me about your merits, among other things, this case is very difficult in general, but a hard part of your argument is that typically in the intersection of somebody's personal beliefs and public accommodation laws tend to win because people need to be able to go to the grocery store and shop for something and not be told, because of X, some immutable characteristic, you're not allowed to shop here. That's basically what public accommodation laws are about. People can believe what they want. People can conduct their personal lives and allow into their home who they want. But when we talk about a public, when you open a business to the public, then you have to serve the public.
Right.
And you can say no shirt, no shoes, no service, but you can't say color of the skin, religion, ethnicity, etc. is a reason why we won't serve you. So here Jackson has added sexual orientation to that list. And why isn't this then an intersection of belief with public accommodation where public accommodation has won those battles, it seems to me?
Well, in this case, the state law would trump the local ordinance. So it's just a simple question of supremacy of state law over local law in terms of what actually would happen under the terms of House Bill 1523. Now, without House Bill 1523, if you read the Jackson Ordinance, and it's not entirely clear how far it extends. The ordinance
would RFRA beat the Jackson Ordinance or would before this statute?
That's not entirely clear. It would be
it's
up to
unclear.
The state.
It's unclear. We don't yet have a case that says whether Mississippi RFRA beats the Jackson Ordinance.
I have not found one, and it would depend on how the Mississippi State Judiciary chooses to interpret the vague and amorphous compelling state interest override. And one needs only to look at Justice Ginsburg's dissent in Hobby Lobby to see that there are a contingent of judges out there who are inclined to give the compelling interest standard a very broad reading when it comes to religious rights asserted by people such as the ones that House Bill 1523 is trying to protect. So no one can know for sure. I'm sorry.
Judges who have to follow a code of ethics that says they should not discriminate against people based on X, Y, Z, and sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. What happens to them in Mississippi? Are they required to follow those ethics rules, or are they, if 1523 goes into effect, can they refuse to address people who fall in this category?
The only thing a judge could claim protection for, possibly under 1523, is choosing not to perform or officiate at a same-sex wedding.
What about the recognition? Can they refuse to perform a divorce proceeding?
No, that's not what the statute says. No, the statute does not protect that.
The marriage?
No, under their duties as a state judge, they must follow the law, and 1523 does not in any way change that. They are not in any way allowed. This statute has been mischaracterized so many times, both during the arguments today. I mean, for example, Ms. Kaplan suggested that that first grade teacher who called out a student for having same-sex parents would be protected from discipline by the statute. That is not what the statute says. Look at Section 37. Because schools are allowed to have viewpoint-neutral policies that allow school officials to discipline teachers for inappropriate conduct like that.
But wouldn't that be discriminating against the teacher for that?
No.
Expressing that
no,
belief?
Not necessarily, because the school could just say, teachers are not supposed to opine one way or the other on homosexuality in the classroom, and then the school's policy is perfectly consistent with the statute. The other hypothetical that Ms. Kaplan mentioned is the issue of restaurants serving people at dinner. That is not a marriage-related service under Section 3.5. Opening up a restaurant to the...
What if it's a rehearsal dinner?
If it's a rehearsal dinner, that is a... If it's a rehearsal dinner being hosted at a restaurant...
Right. I mean, you have a rehearsal dinner for your wedding, and it happens to be a wedding of two women or two men, and then they say, well, we don't want to serve you because you're getting married, and we don't agree with that. What do you do with that?
It's going to be a context-dependent matter. What do they do?
Okay,
is it a marriage... is a lot more clear than the RFRA standard, which is entirely indeterminate when it comes to balancing compelling interest. This statute clarifies. It provides clarity for what will and what will not trump.
Why is it the clarification that public accommodation, mm-hmm. when you open a public accommodation, you can't reverse the Supreme Court's decision that same-sex marriage is lawful?
It's not reversing the decision.
You can't refuse to recognize that. The Supreme Court made that determination, that you can't reverse that in a public accommodation context.
The Supreme Court's decision in Obergefell applies to the state, and it applies to state actors. It imposes no obligation at all on the private sector. Private individuals are still permitted to hold their views about the institution of marriage, and Obergefell says as much. This statute is in no way undermining what the Supreme Court said, because the Supreme Court's decision and the text of the 14th Amendment itself is limited to state action. A restaurant that opens its doors for dinner cannot turn away any patron who walks in the door wanting to be served for dinner on the same terms as anyone else. That is not a marriage-related service. That's serving dinner to the general public. It has nothing to do with marriage. It's not implicated by Section 3.5. And in all events, courts are required by the Supreme Court precedent to defer to the state's reasonable construction of the statute that it's charged with administering.
But your construction isn't binding on a judge, so if...
Not binding on the state, right.
If Mr. Taylor has refused his rehearsal dinner at XYZ restaurant because that restaurant owner doesn't want to bless or be participant in any way in a same-sex marriage, then when there's a lawsuit between Mr. Taylor and that restaurant, then the judge has to decide. The judge isn't
right.
bound by what you told me here today.
But if the judge interprets 1523 any differently from what I said, he is misinterpreting the statute flagrantly. And if he's not reversed on appeal, he should be impeached. It's not what the statute says. We're emphatic about that. It does
Counsel,
not protect restaurateurs.
You're not really saying that if a judge interprets something incorrectly in a lawsuit that we should impeach them.
Not you. The state legislature. What this law does is protect people from being compelled to participate in or lend direct assistance to conduct that violates their conscientious beliefs. It is not a license to discriminate against patrons who come into your store based on their identity or based on their behavior. It is a conscience protection law. It is not a license to discriminate. There are 14 seconds left. If the court has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we respectfully ask the court to vacate the preliminary injunction and remand.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you.
Your case is under submission, and the court is in recess until...